I have a to-do list that feels like somebody just brought in a heavy loader and dumped a ton of crap on top of my head. I'm like...
Welcome to another episode of the Rogue Startups Podcast with Craig Hewitt and Dave Rodenbaugh. This is a podcast documenting the journey as self-funded business founders and sharing lessons, tips, and tricks for businesses following the same path as ours. The journey is long and winding, but we're glad you're joining us for it. And now it's time to go rogue with Dave and Craig.
All righty, welcome to episode 73 of the Rogue Startups Podcast. This week, Craig and I have some big news. How did you like that?
That's excellent. That's excellent.
If we had a background soundtrack that we could use from Lord of the Rings, I totally would have copped it. But, you know, this is what you get on a low FX budget here. Sorry, guys.
That's right. That's right. That's what you get for this being free, everybody.
Exactly.
Oh, man. Yep. So the big news is I've finished all of my Christmas shopping, and we're going to be in the States a week from Saturday. That's the big news.
Hey, congratulations. Welcome back. Yes, yes, big news. Yes.
We are all very excited, Dave, to hear your update next week. But this week is a bit premature to be talking about anything too much, huh?
It is, but I will say, here's what I'll say about it. I bought a SaaS. It is closed. We've gone through due diligence. Everything looks amazing. I'm working with some great sellers. The transaction with FEI was very smooth, and I am very psyched to talk about it more next episode.
Dun, dun, dun. So Dave is a sasshole officially.
I'm a sasshole now, yes. And I am super, super excited. I'm totally buried and overwhelmed. I mean, the sheer volume of my to-do list keeps increasing so quickly each day that – you know, it's gone from excitement to overwhelmed in a very short period of time. I'm still very excited, but there's just obviously so much to do and so many different things I have to master before I can start doing the real work. You know, I have to get into the day-to-day and be able to understand support and handle that, be able to deal with bug fixes and deployments and monitoring and all of this stuff. There's, you know, every time I go through something, I'm like, oh crap, you didn't use this tool. Why aren't you using this tool? They're like, oh, we didn't know about it. I'm like, oh, okay. Add that to my list of something I need to do on this thing. So we're not spending time manually doing that anymore. Yeah. It's, oh God, it's crazy. Oh, it's amazing.
But it's good. I mean, if you had a very short list, it would mean the value you can add to it would be minimal. So I consider that a very good sign.
Yes, I do as well. There's lots of different growth potential directions that I can take this here. There are customers that are seriously excited about this tool. They're using it. They're getting huge value out of it. So, I mean, this is amazing. This is definitely a great fit for me. It was a good price for me too. You know, I didn't have to like mortgage the house, my kids, my left arm, sell off all of our assets and make a voodoo blood sacrifice deal with some crazy witch in the backwoods, you know, none of that kind of stuff. So all of that made for a much smoother transaction.
That's great. That's great. I have to say on a personal note, I'm very impressed at your patience in this process, because as long as we've been doing this podcast, not almost 2 years, you've been looking for something, and that is a very long time to be looking, and I would have bought some piece of crap already, and I'm very impressed that you've been waiting for the right thing to come along. It's a huge lesson for all of us.
Persistence for the win.
Yep, for sure. I think that's a great lesson, yeah.
Yeah, well, we can definitely count the number of times where my sanity has nearly cracked as a result of this search, so I will say that it has definitely tested all limits of my patience. I don't know that I want to be doing this again for a very long time.
Yeah, give yourself a couple of years, build it up, sell it off, and scale up, and go through the whole process again, right?
Well, let's talk in a couple of years before I've got an answer to that question right now, because I'm kind of thinking, fuck no.
Right. So, yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, on the podcast motor front, we've been in full growth mode these days. We took and kind of promoted one of our writers to manager of content, or content marketing manager. So she's doing all of our blog posts, all of our social media, all of our email. And it's great. I can already tell that the engagement on her level has gone up a lot. And yeah, I expect really good things out of our blog. You know, our content has been great for a long time. We had the guys from Audience Ops writing for us. And I mm-hmm. decided that as part of my own sort of education and furthering as an entrepreneur, I needed to decide, you know, this is my time. I need to figure out how to run a content marketing campaign and everything. And this is kind of part of that, is figuring out how to manage an internal content marketing team. And I feel good about the decision. It's an investment, just like anything. But I can already see the type of people we're going to be attracting with the posts that we're writing now is really strong. You know, we attract different types of people with different, I'll say, sort of levels of seriousness of content. Like, we attract a lot of hobbyist podcasters at the beginning when we were writing the blog, and now we've moved all the way to much more of the professional types, and those are our ideal customer. So I think that the consistency and the alignment with the type of content we're writing now should be really good for bringing in new customers. So we'll see. And then we're gonna start running Facebook ads next week. So it'll be the first time we've run paid traffic to the site in general and to our content. We ran some paid traffic to our giveaways in the past, and we'll do another giveaway in January and run some paid traffic to it. But was talking to somebody this week who said, you know, for the overall sort of traffic portfolio of a site and an asset, if you don't have some paid traffic run to it, it's seen as a negative in a buyer's eyes. Not that I'm selling Podcast Mode or anything, I'm not, but I'm always looking at, like, the best businesses are also very sellable, I think. And so how do I continue to build and evolve Podcast Motor to be as good a company as I can? And I think one of them is a nice, you know, well-distributed traffic model. So we're going to start running some Facebook ads and see how it goes.
That is a super smart idea. You know, for all of the businesses that I – speaking of the two-year period that I've been looking, of all the businesses that I've looked at in the 2 years – the strongest businesses are the ones that are always the most interesting to buy. And when you have a diversified traffic portfolio, that's definitely one of the things that makes you way more interesting, because if it's all coming from one source, that looks like a big risk. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you go do due diligence with somebody like Centurica, where they'll do a quick profile on your site for $400, doing an evaluation of, here are the risks, here's the valuation, here are the things that we see that are problems. You know, if they see all your traffic coming from one source, they definitely flag that. And if they see that you don't get any paid traffic, they flag that as well. So, you know, those are smart things to be thinking about.
Yeah, because right now we're a bit at the mercy of kind of like passive leads. We get a lot of organic leads from Google. We get some leads from our blog and like our Facebook group and email and all that kind of stuff now. But there's nothing that I can kind of like push the pedal down on if I wanted to say, double our lead flow. And paid acquisition is the way to do that, I think.
Yeah, but you got to be smart about it, and you got to make sure that your CAC is way lower than your LTV.
Yep.
And you got to make sure that those suckers convert, because you can get tons and tons of paid traffic and nothing happens on it, and that sucks.
Yeah. Yep. That's the biggest thing I'll be doing, is setting it up to be measurable. I think that's the cornerstone of a lot of these good paid traffic campaigns, is that they measure the hell out of everything and only make a decision based on what the results say.
Yep.
So,
yep. Are you seeing a lot higher engagement like we were from the Audience Ops content?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, the Audience Ops stuff is great. It's, they're some of our best performing posts of all times, you know, 2 years into the business now. They're wonderful. So we're trying to do a lot of the same things they did, and kind of as our business is evolving, keep up with, you know, our ideal customer along that path. But yeah, their stuff is wonderful. It's no surprise that Brian is being really successful with what he's doing.
Yeah, I definitely am seeing it's not quite a hockey stick, but it's a steady increase. You know, one of the things that he had said when I first signed up as an Audience Ops customer about 7 months ago, he said it'll be about, you know, somewhere between 3 and 6 months, you'll start to see your organic traffic increase as we start to rank on the keywords that we put on the posts. And I have absolutely seen that down the line here. So, you know, it's not a huge influx of traffic yet, but I'm seeing it slowly growing. You know, everything with Google is a slow, patient game if mm-hmm. you want to stay in it for a long time, and I'm definitely seeing that. So yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, we're still now seeing, you know, new engagement and comments and downloads from lead magnets and stuff, whatever, a couple months later, 6 months yeah. later even. Yeah, it's amazing. Yep.
So yeah, I think we need to get Audience Ops to sponsor the podcast because we keep plugging them so hard.
No, it is. But it is. It's great to say, like, you're with your plugins, you're saying, I want to do content marketing. I want to do it well. I don't want to manage it. I don't want to sort of learn how to do it the right way. And that's what a done for you service does. Yeah, it's wonderful. So speaking of sort of driving traffic and converting leads, this week we are talking about selling, huh?
Everybody's favorite subject, right?
I love it. No, I love selling. It's it's my bread and butter, yeah.
It's totally your bread and butter, yes. For a lot of tech guys like me, I think, you know, sales always has a dirty connotation, and you're thinking about used car salesmen and stuff like that. And, of course, now that I have – when I was doing due diligence on the SaaS, and even before that when I was looking at – previous SaaS solutions, I realized that I really needed to step up my sales game. So one of the books that I bought was To Sell is Human by Dan Pink. Have you read that?
I've read Drive, one of his other books, but I've not read this one. But I kind of thumbed through a few outlines as we were getting ready for this. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're looking to understand sales and you're sort of like me where you don't want to be that used car salesman, but at the same time, you know, you have to learn how to persuade people that your solution solves somebody else's problem, then this is definitely a great book to read. I don't remember who recommended it to me. I think I got it out of the Rhodium community from one of the book lists that I was asking for, along with a bunch of other stuff. But anyway, I have been very impressed. I've read Drive before. Drive was one of my favorite books by Dan Pink about the surprising truth of what motivates us. And so Dan Pink's got another book here, To Sell as Human. This is the one about moving others. And one of the insights that Dan has is that he realized that even though he's in academia and then he does all these lectures and basically writes books about human psychology, he realized that the majority of his job, or at least a significant portion of his job, has basically become something akin to sales. And so he went and started digging into this and figured out that when he did a survey of a few thousand people in the workforce, I want to say it was like 7,000 people, that he was asking, do you do sales for a living? Most people said no. The people who were in obvious sales positions, like, you know, they worked at Best Buy and they were selling electronics or something like that, they said yes, but it was very much the minority. But then when he went and asked the question in a different way, do you have to persuade others as part of what you do? 40% on average across all occupations and across the survey basically said, yes, I have to do this as a significant portion of my job. And even though those aren't exactly sales positions, you know, you might be working in customer support, or you might be working in development, or you might be working in even an office receptionist has to do persuasion all the time. And all of these things here are not official sales positions, but everybody is having to go out there and sell an idea, to sell some creativity, to sell an innovation or something, to convince somebody else that what they would like to do is what somebody else should do, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the I'm not in sales is the ultimate cop-out for people who don't want to, I'll say, admit that they're not comfortable with persuasion and really engaging people in a situation that might be a little uncomfortable. And I think that's the place where a lot of people get scared, is you are asking someone to do something that they may say no to, but the fact is that that happens every day, right? You know, hey, boss, can I work from home? Hey, you know, wife, I'm going to go play golf all day Saturday, whatever it is. Yeah, we're engaged in these things all the time. And I think to go ahead and admit to yourself, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert or a techie or a sales guy or whatever, that that you're engaging in these areas of persuasion is healthy so that you can start understanding how you can have these conversations naturally and feel good about yourself doing it.
Yep. But by the same token, while we have a rise in a variety of careers like entrepreneurship or what Dan Pink called the EdMed sector, where it's basically education and medicine, where you basically are wearing a lot of different hats at any given time, you have to do this persuasion all the time. There is also a flip side to this, which is a little more unique to this particular day and age, and that is we've gone from a buyer beware to a seller beware market, from caveat emptor to caveat venditor. Because there's so much information out there these days, the average buyer is way more empowered than they used to be, say, 10, 20, 30 years ago. Where the perfect example is like when you walk into a car dealership now, you pretty much walk in these days with a full write-up on the car. If you're looking at a specific used car, you probably have the VIN number, you've done a Carfax on it, you've pulled the Kelley Blue Book on it, you know what the invoice is, you know what the used price is, you know what the private sale price is. I mean, there's so much information that you have. If you, you know, go back 20 years ago, that situation was very, very different, where you walked into the car dealership and you felt at a total disparity and that you were just afraid that you were going to get screwed over, and you know, if you didn't know what you were doing, you were always afraid that you were going to get a bad deal out of it. And that situation has definitely changed today, right?
Yeah, and it's everything from Amazon reviews to my former profession in the medical field. There were entire companies that would rate and review our products, and our products were $500,000 products. They would rate and review them and have that information be available for purchase by hospitals. So there is a ton of really high quality information, whether it's sort of crowdsourced like Amazon or eBay and like seller reviews to professional services that create and aggregate this information for the buyers. The buyers are not just enabled, but super well informed these days. And I think it changes the position that you as the salesperson have to create, the relationship to say, I'm not going to sort of sell you on the features and benefits, but position our solution as kind of an entire solution to your problem, not just the, this widget does that, because they already know this.
So you remember a classic sales movie from 1992, right? Your cinema from 1992 is really strong, right?
Right. I was 12. Yeah. No problem.
Yeah. So Glengarry Glen Ross was this crazy movie about salespeople. And Alec Baldwin plays this classic slimy sales guy. And he's the one that wrote up on the board ABC, and you know what that means, right?
Always be closing.
All right, so always be closing. So, you know, if you have seen this movie and you think of ABC, like that's the first thing that comes to mind. And of course, if you follow that up, you're thinking of guys that are used car salesmen wearing cheap polyester plaid suits in a parking lot, you know, sliding up to you Beetlejuice style, and it's totally slimy, right? So Dan Pink, in his book, you know, bringing this back to our subject today, basically has revisited the whole notion of ABC, but has turned it into three different things that are for the modern age because of the fact that we live in this hyper-informed era and that it's no longer buyer beware, it's really seller beware. So those three aspects, which are the meat of what we're going to talk about today, are attunement, buoyancy, and clarity. So attunement is really about understanding the needs of buyers. It's more than just empathy. So the first thing that comes to mind when you think about attunement, if you're in tune with somebody else, you're probably empathetic with them. And that's great for customer support. But attunement is a little bit more than that. It's sort of a balance of your head and your heart. It's not really just pure empathy. And it's also understanding that if you're coming at somebody as a salesperson and you're trying to convince them or persuade them of something, you're actually – you might be in a situation where your power is greater than their power, and they're automatically going to not trust you because of that. So you've got to be careful to understand what kind of a perspective you're coming from and what your power is like. A great example of this is like a doctor. So if you're a doctor and a patient comes to you and says, yeah, I've got this weird rash, and you're thinking to yourself, okay, well, I know, remember in medical school that weird rash in blah, blah means yada, yada, yada. So instead of listening to what the patient has to say and putting yourself in their perspective and really getting into the meat of their problem, if you just sort of come out and go, well, I think it's this. That's a perfect example of where your power as a doctor has distorted your perspective, and now all of a sudden you have no empathy and you have no understanding about what that person is trying to tell you, and therefore you are no longer able to understand their problem as well as if you had just sort of listened. And I don't know, this is the one thing my wife really hates about doctors, is that there's just this definite, I know it more than you do, I'm smarter than you are, so you just tell me your problem and I'll give you the answer sort of thing, as opposed to, I'd like to understand you and then I'd like to help you try to find a solution to whatever it is you're having here, but I'm not just going to jump to a conclusion. Do you ever have that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that it's specific to medicine, and that this isn't a discussion about doctors necessarily, but the same sort of empowerment of buyers is happening in the medical field too. There's reviews on doctors now, and so doctors can't just be the opinionated assholes that they might have used to be. They have to have bedside manner, and they have to sort of understand you and actually sit down and listen to what you're saying. It not only is good sort of medicine and decision making, which is kind of all that being a doctor is, like this giant decision tree, but it also makes the customers, who are actually patients, feel better about the situation that they're in and the process they're going through. And a lot of this goes to kind of asking lots of good questions. And I think we're going to talk about questions later, but that's for me the real kind of key to a lot of this. And, you know, attunement and empathy is, a lot of these are like asking specific open-ended questions so that the customer can kind of get off their chest what they want to say, but also you will learn things that you would never learn if you, quote, drove the conversation.
Right, right. And speaking of driving the conversation here, so one of the interesting things that Dan Pink found about attunement was, so what's the classic, if I were to ask you, who's better at sales, introverts or extroverts, what would you say?
Yeah, the typical would be extroverts.
Right. And so Dan looked into this. He's like, well, I don't know if that's really true. Let's take a look at that. So they actually graphed sales performance over what their personality type was. So they did some personality tests. They looked at sales performance over some period of time. And the research came back with a surprising bell curve. So extroverts still did better than introverts, but neither of them did as well as ambiverts. So ambiverts are basically somebody who is half extrovert, half introvert. You're really neither of the two, or you're kind of in between. Sometimes you like being around people. Sometimes you like being by yourself. And it was the ambiverts that were the ones that turned out to be the best sellers, because they were the ones that were most likely to be able to reduce their power and take the customer's perspective to get that empathy, to get that understanding, but still be aggressive, and that's probably the wrong word, but to still be extroverted enough to go and actually ask the questions in the first place, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think generally introvert and extrovert are not the right words to use for this. I think that what people typically the typical sort of like assumption of the definition of introvert and extrovert is like, they like being around people and in big groups if they're an extrovert, and they like being at home in front of a book or their computer if they're an introvert. And it really is where you kind of get your power from and your passion. Do you get jazzed by being in a big group of people, and is that something that fulfills you, or does it drain you and you like being home sort of alone by yourself? It's not sort of what you like, it's what sort of powers you. And so I think it makes, if you look at it in that sense, it makes more sense. The results here make more sense, that Neither of those on the extremes are best, but somewhere in the middle makes sense because you are a lot of times in a one-on-one situation, not in big groups and not by yourself.
Right, right. There was a third point that Dan had made in his book on attunement here, and that was about mimicry. But that really, it's not something that you can really do on the internet. So if you're doing sales on a web page, you know, you can't really use mimicry to sort of mirror somebody else's body language. And he has a whole discussion on that. If you're interested in it, I would suggest reading the book because it talks about specific things. Because you don't want to look like the creepy person that's copying somebody else's mannerisms. which was hilarious to go through this and read this. And he's like, okay, do this, but don't do all these other creepy things because you're just going to be weird.
Right, right.
I'm like, yeah, no shit. That would be really bizarre if somebody started doing that. But it was interesting because if you're in a social situation, I think knowing that and knowing that you could start doing that helps to sort of break down some personal barriers when you're talking to somebody else. But it definitely is something that you want to be very careful about.
Yeah, yeah. So the next thing that Dan talks about in this is, in terms of personality and outlook on things, is something he calls buoyancy. This is the B of ABCs. And he sort of relates it to a combination of a gritty spirit and a sunny outlook. So he goes through a few questions and sort of perspectives that someone who is selling should ask themselves. And of the three kind of things that he proposes, the first question that you should ask is, can I succeed? And I think this is a good exercise in self-talk, which is really important when you're kind of jazzing yourself up for what could be a challenging or uncomfortable situation. And I think that when you propose this question to yourself, then you start coming to the fact that, you know, maybe not, but if you really want to, then you have to sort of start understanding what are the things that could make you succeed.
One of the points that Dan made in there is that there's really sort of three different kinds of internal dialogue that you can have with yourself. There's the negative one, which is where people are like, ah, I can't do this. There's no way. I mean, I'm just not smart enough. I'm not, you know, you're feeling like it's impossible. So it's like the opposite of Stuart Smalley, right?
Right, right.
And then there's the flip side of that, which is more like the Tony Robbins, you know, you're good enough, you're smart enough, and gosh darn it, people like you. Actually, that was Stuart Smalley, but it was derived from, you know, sort of the sugar, syrupy, sweet affirmation style of Tony Robbins and Zig Ziglar and others that are like, yeah, you got this, man, go for it. And he found that neither of those was really conducive to sort of a long-term grittiness. But it was only when you actually sort of – and child alert, if you for those of you without kids and have never watched Nickelodeon, you will not understand this reference, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway. Bob the Builder. So – what does Bob the Builder ask every single time?
So I have watched Bob the Builder, and I don't know.
Oh, my God. You're disappointing me. You're killing me today, Craig. He says, and it's, you know, I don't watch a ton of Bob the Builder, but my nephews do. And so when I've been over there, I can hear this in the background because the whole, like, background audience of the show screams it out. Can we do this? And, you know, that's Bob's ever persistent question every time they run into a problem. Can we do this? And then they figure out how to do this. So the Bob the Builder style talk allows you to open up a dialogue inside your head where you figure out, all right, what do I need to do to make this happen? It's not like I'm going to do this no matter what, because that's just sort of like it's almost self-delusional, right? And mm-hmm. It's not defeating where you're saying I can't do this when you haven't really even looked at it. Can I do this gives you the opportunity to explore what it is you're weak at and what it is you're able to do and you already know. So that's where he found that people were the most successful, the ones that did this internally when they were asking themselves that question.
Yeah, no, that's great. I think it sort of coming to grips with your doubt is a great way to start addressing it and coming up with ways to be successful. Yeah, I like it. Mm-hmm. So the next sort of topic that he brings up with these three ideas is being mostly positive with your thoughts, but sort of being, like we're mentioning, being honest with yourself about some of those doubts so that you don't become overly delusional. Because I think that this could lead to sort of arrogance, and coming back a little bit to attunement, it would bring you out of touch with the people that you're talking to.
Or at the very worst, self-delusion.
Yeah.
Right, where you're just like, oh, I can absolutely do this. I've got this. I'm smart enough. I have no problem, you know, and then you go out and you try it and you're like, oh, that didn't work. Because right. I didn't think about, you know, point one, point two, point three. If you're not being honest with yourself and you're not prepared to deal with those things, then, you know, you're going to have a problem. But you still need a level of positivity. You can't, you know, for every positive thought that you're having, you can't have an equal negative thought, because those just aren't – they're going to cancel each other out. It's not enough to motivate you. So they found – Dan Pink found through some research that it was like a 3-to-1 golden ratio. So if your thoughts are like 3 times the number of positive thoughts to – the 1 time of negative thoughts, that was sort of the minimal level that motivated you forward. So if you're hanging around really negative people, you probably have noticed that those negative people aren't necessarily ones that are getting things done. And this is part of it. They're not positive enough, but there is definitely an upper limit. They found that the golden ratio was 3-to-1, but the upper limit was about 11-to-1. So if somebody is like just this constant stream of self-affirmations and it's dribbling out of their mouth of how awesome they are and whatever, that it just becomes a point of self-delusion. And, you know, then they're not effective at all at that point.
Yeah. You know, I think this optimistic nature is inherent in all of us as entrepreneurs, and is maybe something that we should be careful of more than other people who are in sales that are in, you know, sort of internal sales for a company. I think that our very nature has to lead us to being optimistic and believing that good things will come in the end. But the fact is it might not, right? So I think, you know, there's so many unknowns with business that the optimism within sales definitely needs to be there. Within business, I think we have to be, trust but verify, right? So like cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, optimistically realistic, I think, is how I would state it at this point.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
And one thing that he did point out is that you want to be sort of optimistic overall to see things like when you get a rejection. So you're doing sales, you're getting rejected all the frickin' time.
Not if you're good.
Well, okay. If you're Glengarry Ross, then I suppose you're not doing that. But you know, if you're the rest of us mortals, then every time that you're going out there, you're getting rejected on a fairly regular basis. And you know, this can definitely drive some pessimism. Especially once you get past that, you know, the initial optimism of whatever it is I'm starting has worn off, you need to be able to see things like rejections as temporary and not permanent. And there was a great sales example in here of a Fuller Brush salesman that basically would go, and every single day he faced rejection, and he'd go into these lawyers' offices and they would say no, and they would come back. And he would come back a month later and do it again. But the reason he was able to keep coming back is that in his mind, he would look at the general situation and say to himself, oh, well, they rejected me because they were having a bad day, or maybe cash flow was tight that month. But all of these things that he pointed out, they were temporary conditions, things that were not going to be permanent forever and ever and ever. And they were things that gave him hope to come back. So there was like optimism within the rejection there. And that's really important, because if you don't have that optimism, you're not going to be able to get through your challenges, and you're going to lose confidence when things get hard. And that's how you maintain that grittiness there, along with the sunny outlook.
Yeah, I think this is a tough one, though, because you have to make sure you're really being honest with yourself about this, that, you know, they didn't buy from me today because it's not the right budget time, or it's not, you know, whatever. If you're going to do this, I would strongly recommend having kind of hard data points around this, so that you're not lying to yourself. Because it's easy to say, oh, they were having a bad day, or oh, you know, the receptionist doesn't like me, or whatever it is. But if you're going to come up with an excuse all the time, then this is a self-defeating kind of part of the process. And it's easy to do.
Sure.
It's easy when someone slams the door in your face, say, oh, it's because of X, which is tough to overcome and tough to quantify. But if you're not really honest with yourself, I think this is something that could really hold you back.
Yep. All right. So the last point that Dan had here was about clarity. So this is really about explaining not just why you're selling something and what you're selling it, but why the buyer may not be a good fit for this thing and why they don't necessarily want it. Clarity really makes it pretty straightforward for the buyer to understand, is this the best thing for me? And you can also help the buyer push past resistance, because there's definitely, and I'm one of these guys, I'll tell you this right now. When I know that somebody is selling to me, it's like I have this automatic resistance, like, I am not going to be sold your product. I am too smart for that. Because to me, sales feels like you're pushing me to do something I don't want to do necessarily, as opposed to you're helping me find a solution to my problem. That's just sort of the classic sales resistance that I've had and grown up with for a long time. And as a result of that, that resistance is something that you can try to overcome, but not in a forceful, I'm going to ram this down your throat kind of way, but in a way that helps the buyer understand that what you've got to offer actually has some positive stuff behind it. And so he talks a lot about reframing and changing the buyer's perspective, but the best example that I found of this was it was called a jolting question. And so the example that he gave was, let's say you're trying to get your daughter to study, and your daughter, you say, go up to your room and study. No, I don't want to study right now. So instead of going through that exercise and brain damage, which eventually will result in somebody crying and somebody yelling, you start off with a very simple question. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being not at all ready and 10 being absolutely totally ready, how ready are you to study? So then your daughter answers the question. And here's the jolting part. When they give you that answer, you ask them why it wasn't lower, because chances are they're not going to give you a 1 or maybe a 2. They're probably going to be somewhere in the middle. As soon as you ask that question back to them, all of a sudden it jolts them out of their thing, I don't want to study. Like, wait a minute, why am I not totally not ready to study? And then they start looking at all of the positive aspects. Oh, well, I guess I am in a quiet room. That helps me be ready to study. Oh, well, I guess I have my stuff at home, so that means I'm a little more ready to study. Oh, I guess I have time right now. Yeah, I guess that means I'm more ready to study. I guess that's why I answered that. So now all of a sudden you've got three positive things that you can build on with your daughter to say, all right, well, you've got these three things. What other things do you need to be ready to study? And so now it's not, are you ready to study? Why aren't you studying? It's, how can I help you get to where you need to be to study? So that is an amazing question. And it allows somebody to see positive aspects of it, creating a potential in a situation instead of like this negative resistance. Oh, God, I'm not going to do this sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. No, I love this. And I think that this ties into to something else that Dan talks about, which helps uncover kind of the root cause of this resistance and the real reason why someone might have hesitation about buying. And it's called the five whys. And I believe this is from the original Toyota guys, and they're, I believe, some of the originators of this Six Sigma, like constant improvement stuff. But the five whys really get at the core of an issue. And so it's, my daughter doesn't want to study. Well, why not? Well, because I had a long day. Well, why'd you have a long day? Well, because, someone was being mean to me at school or whatever it is. But, the idea is that if you can ask why five times to the same topic, that you'll drill down far enough to uncover all of the bullshit layers of the onion and get to the real core of how somebody feels and what their motivations are behind, buying or finding a solution to their problem. And for me, in my sales experience, this is the key. This is really the key. It's not that, my old job, we want to buy this equipment. We can serve our patients better. No, it's because the fucking hospital down the street just bought one and they look like a bunch of schmoes now. So I think that doing this more and more, you'll find some of the most bizarre reasons why people want to buy stuff that you would never know if you didn't ask good questions and in this kind of framework.
Right. But it's getting to that clarity of understanding the true reason behind it and what motivates somebody that really is important there. And another thing that Dan had mentioned there was a book, and this is something that I think I mentioned on the podcast before, but there's a book by Robert Cialdini that he's a professor at the University of Arizona of psychology, and he talks about the psychology of persuasion. And this is like – this dates back to early 2000s, but he's done an updated edition about 4 years ago, and it has some fantastic stuff about what motivates people. How do you change people's motivations? How can you determine their motivations? All kinds of stuff like that. We could do a whole podcast on that alone, but that's definitely something that helps get you that clarity when you can understand the psychology behind it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I think once you have the clarity of the real psychology of someone and really where they're coming from, that then a natural resolution to their problem is something that everyone is very happy to have, right? So at the end of a sales process, kind of like the end of a sales funnel for us online, the choice is obvious. So the only possible thing they could do is to buy your thing if you've done a good job of understanding their problem and laying and positioning your solution in the right way. The only solution is going to be yours, and that's kind of the goal, is to understand their needs well enough and to position your solution properly so that that choosing you is obvious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. An example that Dan gave in the book here was that by giving somebody an off-ramp to a clear-cut action that they can take, it has about a 3x increase in the action, the rate of actions that people actually take on this. So the example that he gave was about food donations, and they sent out two different varieties of a letter. One of them that had very clear details on specific steps to take: go buy this, take it to this place, buy this amount, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Very, very specific details about what somebody had to do to donate food versus a general one asking for help. And, you know, having some vague suggestions in there. And they found that the rate of response and the rate of action was 3 times higher on the specific one versus the general one. So this is something that helps you in your sales funnel. Make sure that each level of your sales funnel has something very specific that that customer can follow. So instead of like a vague learn more, you know, you might say something like sign up now or try for free. You know, the language matters a lot by giving your customer a clear direction about where they should be going next. What is it that they need to do for the next action? And making sure that they understand that really well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So one of the other, you know, with the changing of the times and us being in a situation where buyers are very well informed and empowered, something else that's just changed a lot is especially in the online world, there's not sort of the idea of an elevator pitch. You know, there's marketing copy and there's email and there's social media and tweets. But to think about your value proposition should still be very concise. The idea of an elevator pitch still applies. It's just applied in a different way now. If you can't explain what your product does and the solution you provide in a sentence, I think you have some work to do. Someone who really impresses me with this all the time is Josh Pigford, so Baremetrics. He says what Baremetrics does in like 3 words, SaaS analytics for Stripe. And he's really got that defined, and now it's more than Stripe. But you really need to understand the core of what you do so that you can talk around your product, and it shows that you understand your customers really well, I think.
Yeah, yeah. He could make a five-word pitch now, SaaS analytics for your payment provider, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
I think technically that's 6. Neither of us counted the word 4. Oh, well. And of course, you know, there's other important things when you're dealing with trying to get clarity. You always want to ask open-ended leading questions. So when somebody responds to you with a question and you want to agree with it, you don't just say yes. You say yes and then add some stuff in there that the customer can then respond to, which gives you a way to improve and facilitate the conversation. The more you can get somebody to talk about what it is that they are interested in and what their problem is, the more likely you are to reach clarity to understand their problem well enough that you can provide that solution.
Yeah, so this is something I put into practice on all of our inbound email requests for additional information. It's always, yeah, here's a little bit of information about our products and answer their specific question. I always end the email with a very open question that allows the customer to start talking about what they're doing and what their motivations are for podcasting or finding a podcast editing provider. So it's a nice way to keep the conversation going if you're either in person or on email, because asking an open-ended question that is sort of truly about the person that you're talking to is going to give you a really high kind of response rate back.
Yeah, this works in customer support as well. I always end every single customer support email that I have with an open-ended, you know, please let me know if you have any other questions or issues. And let me tell you, there are plenty of people that have no problem letting me know about their questions or issues as soon as I've made that statement. And maybe they would have been fine with it before, but it seems like I have a very high response rate as a result of that. And I'm sure the fact that I've left myself open in there allows the customer the freedom and the motivation to continue to increase that dialogue. And if you don't have that dialogue, you're not going to get any clarity.
Yeah. Yeah. As painful as all that support is for you, I know that in the long run, your solution won't be successful without you understanding your customer that well.
Absolutely
And getting that tough feedback sometimes.
Yep. All right. Well, if you have any thoughts about Dan Pink's To Sell as Human or any questions, we'd love to hear from you. Email us podcast@roguestartups.com. And if you have a minute, we would love a review from you on iTunes. And we hope you have a fantastic week. Stick around for next week's when Dave does the big SaaS reveal. Okay, that sounds so
cheesy. You've been wanting to do that for 2 years now.
Oh, yeah, I have. All right, well, anyway, we'll see you next week.
And that's our episode for this week. If you have any questions or comments, please let us know at podcast@roguestartups.com. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Rogue Startups. And be sure to visit roguestartups.com for full show notes on each episode. If you're enjoying the show, we'd sure appreciate a review in iTunes. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.